I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Andrew Gross, New York Times best-selling author of the new novel, The Fifth Column. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week, we commemorated the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks, and there was something ironic about that. The number 18 in Jewish tradition is, of course, the numeric equivalent of Chai, which means life. The World Trade Center and Pentagon murders perpetrated by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 were the opposite of an affirmation of life. And the responses these horrific acts provoked and catalyzed led to great death and destruction around the world. Nearly 3,000 people were murdered that day, and the circles of grief and loss extended far beyond the many victims to their families, friends, and communities. The emotional trauma extended further still and severely damaged our nation and our world. 9/11 changed many things, virtually none of them for good. Forces were unleashed that we scarcely understand even now, 18 years later, and over which we are not really in control. You know, I chaired the 9/11 commemorations here in Tucson, Arizona for 10 years and coordinated and participated in many events remembering those who died. In every one of those ceremonies, we chose to create bonds of respect, honor, and love across all boundary lines of religion and race. We did this because it was right. But we also did this because we needed to demonstrate to those who performed these despicable acts in the hopes of destroying human solidarity that they actually create the opposite effect from what they intend. Those acts of violence and evil brought Americans together and engendered respect, understanding, and love among people with varying beliefs and of different races and origins. What I noticed over the 10 years of 9/11 commemorations I chaired and the many I participated in later was that interest and participation waned over time. In 2001, we all needed to gather and share and pray and heal one another. In 2002, we still needed to gather to pray and mourn and remember. But each year thereafter, no matter how moving the ceremonies or how broad a group we gathered, our all-time high was 24 different religious denominations represented at our Tucson Multi-Faith Alliance service. The numbers of attendees diminished over time. It's the way of the world. Immediate tragedy becomes memory and quickly moves into history before we even notice. This year, most of us saw 9/11 as a time to mourn those whose lives were stolen from them. Some saw it as a time to focus on the war against terrorism and religious insanity, such as the radical, evil form of Saudi Islam that intoxicated the perpetrators of 9/11. But some of us chose to see this date as a reminder of what America can be when it wants to be. At a time of great trauma and crisis, what was most extraordinary was the way Americans pulled together. We reached out across all those boundary lines of race, creed, color, and politics, and supported each other. Southerners and Midwesterners and Arizonans cared about New York. Red state and blue state differences didn't matter. Republicans and Democrats bonded over shared tragedy and the dedication to healing, strength, and pride. I'd like to suggest we look back in a different way at the aftermath of 9/11. Not because there was anything to be nostalgic about around 9/11. It was horror and disaster, shock, and a national loss of innocence and the sense of security, but there was a quality to the way we Americans responded that teaches us something essential we may have forgotten recently. After 9/11, when things seemed blackest, Americans chose to seek each other's understanding, respect, support, and love, and to offer those to one another freely and with great concern and care. We need not wait until truly horrific tragedy strikes to act that way. Thank God and our U.S. intelligence services that we do not face anything as terrible as 9/11 today. But at a time of ever-increasing national discord and division, of the endless online cultivation of mutual disrespect and hatred, we can take an essential lesson from that terrible time. We can personally and collectively choose, instead, to build respect, understanding, and love in our society. We can reach out across those religious lines and celebrate the greatest strength of America, our amazing diversity. We can demonstrate caring and kindness in place of anger and hostility. We can show respect for one another's faith, race, gender, identity, even politics. And we can choose to do what Americans are supposed to do. We can reject the temptations of easy stereotyping and quick judgment, and do then what Americans are really best at in a pinch. We can pull together and seek to make our country and perhaps our world truly better, more generous, more respectful, more gracious. If we choose to do this, well, then the 18th anniversary of 9/11 will not have passed in vain, and we will truly be choosing to affirm life. Speaking of choosing life, that's a central theme of the Jewish High Holy Days, now just 2 weeks away. To play us in this morning in preparation for Rosh Hashanah 5780, here's Dina Propus and Cantor David Propus singing Barosh Hashanah Yikatevu V'Yom Tzom Kippur Yechatemu. On Rosh Hashanah it is written, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed.
Barosh Hashanah Yikatevu V'Yom Tzom Kippur Yechatemu. Barosh Hashanah
Yom Tov.
That was Barosh Hashanah for the coming High Holy Days, beginning 2 weeks from tonight. Or really, starting this coming Saturday night with Slichot programs and services. Join us at my own congregation Beit Simcha at 7:30 p.m. this Saturday for Havdalah Dessert, a showing of the excellent film A Serious Man on its 10th anniversary, a discussion and study session in the beautiful, haunting Slichot services. It's this Saturday night at Congregation Beit Simcha, 7315 North Oracle Road in Tucson. www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call us at 520-276-5675. Our guest this morning, Andrew Gross, is the wildly successful best-selling author of many thrillers, and he now has a new historical fiction novel set during World War II, The Fifth Column. Find out what provoked his renewed Jewish interest and identity when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Andrew Gross is the New York Times best-selling author, not just New York Times, but also international bestsellers, The One Man, The Saboteur, The Blue Zone, Don't Look Twice, The Dark Tide, and so on. He's the co-author of 5 New York Times number one bestsellers with James Patterson and has now shifted to historical fiction. His new book is called The Fifth Column, and it's centered around World War II. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you.
So this is a little bit of a shift, historical fiction instead of more contemporary thrillers. Is it different?
It's way different and it has a higher onus of responsibility and purpose, I think. The main reason I switched was, after writing 9 conventional thrillers and, you know, several of them making the New York Times list, I wanted to write books of sort of greater heft and larger themes and, books that were much more atmospheric in their setting and transported my readers, not just put them in suspense. And the first book of this that I did was called The One Man, and it's a book about my wife's family's, my wife's father's experiences in World War II and the Holocaust, and it's about a third of it is set at Auschwitz. And for me, that was sort of a transformational book. Obviously, when you're writing about the Holocaust, especially as someone who was sort of writing conventional thrillers, the bar of accuracy and setting is a little higher than when you're writing about opiate addiction or something in South Florida. So there was a much greater sense of responsibility, and also in terms of that the stories themselves, the family stories, are sacrosanct, so they have to be treated well with respect. And my book last year was called Button Man, which I would actually encourage you to read if you haven't, from a Jewish perspective, because I've done 30 and probably have another 15 evenings talks in Jewish venues related to this book, because it's the story of the origin of the women's clothing business in New York from the Lower East Side in its clash with Jewish organized crime. Louis Lepke and people like that.
Right, Murder Inc. and all the stuff that developed out of it.
Yep, absolutely, Murder Inc. And for whatever reason, it's sort of given me this niche, this and now this next book, The Fifth column that I'm not only writing historicals, but writing historicals with a bit of a Jewish component to it. So the responsibilities, are greater there too. I kind of call it my own personal aliyah. I'm not sure why I found this niche, and I don't even belong to a temple at the moment, Rabbi. I got to be frank with you.
That's okay, Andrew. We can fix that anytime, I promise.
That would be long distance, but I'll give it a try when we're in Tucson. Will they let me out to from Canyon Ranch?
If they let you out from Canyon Ranch to drive to my show, we will be delighted to welcome you.
But I kind of call it my own aliyah because instead of going maybe back to the Holy Land, I'm going back to my own Jewish roots, and I like bringing these stories forward. So I guess in that lumbering answer to your question, yeah, it's different, and it comes with a heightened sense of responsibility.
It does, and a kind of transformation. We will talk much more with Andrew Gross about his new book, The Fifth Column, and writing in general. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, is a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrating our first services, classes, and events this fall, and our very first Jewish High Holy Days in just 2 weeks. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at 7315 North Oracle for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For our inaugural High Holy Day services, everyone is welcome. There is no charge to attend Beit Simcha on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but pre-registration is required. Call 520-276-5675 to sign up for the High Holy Days at Beit Simcha. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, the coming High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, 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 or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, or go to our website. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and its fastest growing at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we've been talking actually a little more domestically about smaller Jewish communities and how they sometimes manage to pull together and sometimes manage to pull apart. In larger American cities, which we both grew up in, you in St. Louis, me in Los Angeles, there used to be combined Jewish community events that brought everybody together, and they really did. And they weren't just, say, sponsored by the Federation to prove we have one community, but there were, for example, in Los Angeles, Denver, other places, there was a combined Beit Din, a technical Jewish court for conversions. Right. Orthodox, conservative, and reform rabbis sat together and made decisions.
And there was, at least in St. Louis, a Vod HaIr that included all the denominations.
All of them, or boards of rabbis included right. people, and they still do in many places. That began to deteriorate, break down, and kind of polarize. I think in the 1980s, maybe even the late 70s, it started. And I'm still not exactly sure why.
Well, I don't know when or how the breakdown began. I do know that from like 1974 to 2001, I lived outside the United States.
Yeah,
so I was like completely detached from any trend in America. But I did notice a huge difference when I came back in terms of how polarized and factionalized all the Jewish communities, especially in larger cities,
right.
had become. And even within the Orthodox world, there are factions, and this one doesn't speak to that one, and I wouldn't go to that shul in a million years, and that rabbi's not really kosher, whatever. I mean, it's possibly worse there than it is in the other denominations.
I know, it's funny because people think the Orthodox world is some unified whole and nothing could be much further from
right.
the truth.
Right. It's certainly not monolithic. I remember from one of the trips I led 2 or 3 years ago, there was a really Orthodox couple, although the woman had grown up conservative. And her husband was amazed at how many different ways people in the group had of observing Jewish dietary laws. And he said, there's only one type of kashrut. How can all these people come up with their own? And I quoted a friend of mine who always says, Allah machin ira eigene Shabbos. Everybody makes their own Shabbos. Everybody makes their own kashrus. Everybody has their own set of rules that is somehow tweaked. And this guy said, oh, but that can't be. There's only one set of rules that's in the Talmud. He happens to be a Talmud professor. But then I pointed out to him that where he lives in Israel, in the holy city of Jerusalem, there's lots of different types of kashrut certificates for restaurants. Some are what?
Look, no, I'm going to amplify that. If you walk into the market to buy cheese, there's all of these different gradations of kashrut. They're all kosher to somebody on the outside, but there's badatz, the Beit Din Tzedek. And like, it's the same cheese, but some people will only buy the ones with this hechsher from this rabbi. I mean,
yeah, but that's not only true in the market. That's true of restaurants.
Exactly.
They have the different types of certification, and it's glatt or badatz or lamihadrin, whatever. It's not enough just to have the basic, this is a kosher restaurant.
Right.
For some people, you know, that's a grade D from the health department. You
right.
need to have a grade A or they won't eat there. So, I mean, I don't really know when or why we did this to ourselves, but I have the feeling, almost a conviction, that in the long run, it's not constructive.
No, I don't think it is. Talk about Klal Yisrael, the unity of the peoplehood of Israel. That's really the whole point. And if we can find a way to emphasize that rather than our pilpulistic differences, I think we have a much greater possibility of success in the long run. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie goes to see her rabbi, complaining about her bad headaches. She whines, cries, and talks about how miserable her life is for hours. All of a sudden, Sadie shouts out, overjoyed, Rabbi, your holy presence has cured me. My headache is gone. And the rabbi replies, No, Sadie, your headache's not gone. I have it now. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, no headaches. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world, and how long should we expect it to take? This week's Torah portion, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how to live in society. We are commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, and the stranger. We are to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, to uphold it, to cherish it, to make it our own. And we are told of the blessings that will be ours if we can do this, and the curses we will bring on ourselves if we cannot. This covenant was large and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't either easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and needy, to welcome the stranger, meaning the immigrant, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't manage always to give their full tithes, to make pilgrimage to the temple, to declare their gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were times they didn't even provide adequately for the widow and the orphan, let alone the stranger. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, nonetheless made them better people and made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, return to the right course, not punishment. Positive societal change was not instantaneous but evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors, and was codified as a practical framework by the rabbis in the Talmud. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. After 2.5 years of verbal and public policy attacks and executive branch persecution directed at the weakest members of our society, immigrants, people trying to achieve citizenship and refuge, their young children among them, we have a responsibility as Jews, as Americans, as decent human beings to challenge this policy directly and publicly. It isn't right. Putting children in cages, denying them beds and bathrooms, isn't acceptable human conduct. We can make tshuva, return to the ideals that we possess. It's time now to do so. Our guest this morning, New York Times best-selling author Andrew Gross, has many thrillers in his bibliography, but now he has a great new historical novel, a thriller too, though, about World War II. It's excellent. It's called The Fifth Column. Find out why an aspect of its story was pivotal to Andrew Gross's exploration of his own Jewish identity. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Jewish Agency for Israel's annual World Jewish Population figures have just been released. They reveal that Jews continue to be spread throughout the world, of course, although we are now mostly concentrated in major countries. According to research by Hebrew University of Jerusalem professor Sergio Della Pergola, the global Jewish population in 2019 is about 14.6 million. There are 170 countries where at least 100 Jews live, but 84% of global Jewry lives either in Israel or the U.S. Della Pergola defined a country's core Jewish population as anyone who identified himself or herself as Jews, anyone without a religion who was identified as Jewish by a respondent in the same household, or anyone with Jewish parentage who does not necessarily identify with a particular religion. If we use the broader definition of Israel's law of return, anyone with a Jewish grandparent, the number of Jews would swell to 23.5 million. Here are the top 10 countries by core Jewish population, compared with the 2012 edition of this study done 7 years ago. Israel is number one. It has 6,153,500 Jews. Its population grew 10.2%, that is its Jewish population. The U.S. has 5,700,000. Its Jewish population grew 5.1% in 7 years. France has 453,000 people. It's the third largest Jewish population in the world, but its population shrank 5.6% in the last 7 years. Canada, 395,000 Jews. It's fourth on the list. It grew 5.3%. The UK, Britain, and such, 290,000 Jews. Its population shrank 0.3%. Argentina has 180,000 Jews. Its Jewish population shrank a little less than 1%. Russia, 172,000 Jews. Its Jewish population grew 11%. Germany, 116,000, and its Jewish population shrank 2.5%. Australia, 113,000 Jews. Its Jewish population grew 1.3%. And number 10 on the list, Brazil, has 93,000 Jews. Its population shrank 2%. South Africa, Ukraine, Hungary, Mexico, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Italy also have core Jewish populations of over 25,000. In a great story that proves repentance and return can occur for buildings as well as people, a Tel Aviv strip club shut down after Israeli police raids repeatedly found prostitution and drugs. Well, that place will now become the home of a synagogue, a spiritual community for that space. From brothel to shul, what could be a more complete transformation? The Pussycat Show Club took over the widely known Colosseum building in Tel Aviv's Atarim Square near the beach in 2000. It was repeatedly raided by police, who found foreign women working as prostitutes in the back rooms. The club was eventually shut down after the Tel Aviv nonprofit Task Force on Human Trafficking and Prostitution convinced the city not to renew the club's license after suspending it in 2017. It was evicted earlier this year. The new tenants are a spiritual community called Beit Tfilah, the House of Prayer, which has become a popular organizer of Friday evening Shabbat services on Tel Aviv's beach promenade, the fabulous Tel Aviv Port Shabbat. Until now, they had rented out space for prayer around the city. The building is in a process of becoming a hub for social, cultural, and spiritual events, including but not exclusively Jewish studies, Shabbat and Holy Day celebrations, such as our musical Kabbalot Shabbat. Rabbi Esteban Gottfried, Beit Tfilah's director, said. Rabbi Esteban Gottfried, of course, is a past guest of Two Jewish. For now, it was a punctual collaboration that Beit Tfilah Yisraeli was hosted at the place. The social entrepreneurs behind this are just at the beginning of setting the content of the future center. We wish them great success in their new digs. One of the great experiences of an Israeli summer is to be in Tel Aviv from late June to late August and attend Friday night at the Tel Aviv Port Shabbat, wearing shorts and a t-shirt, participating in a Kabbalat Shabbat led by Beit Tfilah Yisraeli, with the sun gradually setting into the Mediterranean behind the musicians and the rabbi. And now they'll have a wonderful setting to do the same thing when it isn't summer. Can't wait to visit them in their new digs for Shabbat. And there's another great new Netflix show you must stream. It's the short series created about Israel's Man in Damascus, starring Sacha Baron Cohen, and called The Spy, about Eli Cohen. Cohen provided information that proved crucial to Israel's victory over the Syrians in the Six-Day War. Don't miss binging this great new show. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Andrew Gross is the wildly successful international best-selling author of the new book, The Fifth Column, set in World War II. I just want to briefly mention one aspect of the book that I found really quite important, and it's maybe a lost period of American history. You talk about the German-American Bund, at one point in the book, which people may not realize just how much anti-Semitism was part of the fabric of America building up to World War II. Was that a surprise for you to discover that? Did you know about that all along?
It was both a surprise to discover it, and at the same time, it was my initial motivation for writing the book.
Really?
The book begins on the night of November 22nd, 1939, which was the night of where 22,000 supporters of Nazism packed Madison Square Garden in New York for a hate-filled rally to listen to speeches by the head of the Bund, the National Socialist Bund, Fritz Kuhn, and Father Coughlin, who was a noted anti-Semite, and others. And I just couldn't believe that I live in New York or in Westchester, and I couldn't believe that, you know, in general that this could happen, in New York City that this could happen. It was fascinating to me, and I chose to start the book on the night of that event. But as you say, this is a really sort of neglected period in American history, because the perception is always here that we came in World War II, and we always sort of stood up and came in, and obviously our involvement was decisive, and we stood on the side of good. Well, of course we did, except that World War II raged for 2 years without our involvement, and our country was cleaved into this division between the people who wanted to get into the war and come to Britain's defense, and basically Roosevelt, and the isolationists who wanted America to stay out of it, that it wasn't our war, whose chief figure was aviator Charles Lindbergh. And the kind of anti-Semitism that was part of the State Department, the acceptance of Nazi Hitler and Nazism. I think Hitler was Man of the Year in 1936, Time Man of the Year.
Right.
The State Department was notably anti-Semitic, and there was this acceptance of Nazism that, because at that point, let's face it, while persecution existed in Europe, obviously Kristallnacht had taken place in 1938. The Holocaust hadn't come to light, and so Hitler's ultimate, authoring, you know, the final solution, no one, you know, wasn't apparent. So there was a lot of acceptance of Germany, and that's the other sort of element that I wanted to write this book about, because this book is really about the Nazis next door, if that's the right way to put it.
No, it's exactly
in this case, down the hall.
Right.
You know, down the hall.
Well, and then, of course, you know, that's kind of the central theme of the book is, you know, these are apparently neighbors. Theoretically, they could be friends, but they're actually working for Hitler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people who were the most, I mean, this was a worldly, charming Swiss couple. This, of course, is fiction, but...
Right. Cover story.
You know, lived down the hall, and in fact were anything but who they claimed to be, were agents of Germany. And when it turns out that America does enter the war, and Germany declares war on the U.S. and we on them, and Japan, suddenly that threat of these people becomes far more lethal. And my main character, Charles Mossman, just to sort of set the stage, is in a bar when we meet him, and he's sort of fallen down a lot of the rungs of self-respect, losing a brother in the Spanish Civil War and losing his job as a history professor at Columbia because of his last name. There was anti-Semitism in the Ivies as well then. And he actually picks an unfortunate fight with some of the people that came from that speech, from the garden that I described, who challenge him for being Jewish, and a bystander is killed as a result of that. So here's a guy that's totally fallen from grace, totally kind of a disgraced guy, and only he can see certain things in terms of this Swiss couple, and no one else can see what he sees. But because of his stature, nobody believes him. He's just not an acceptable witness, and he's so flawed. So it was really those three things lumped together, the Nazi next door kind of thing, witness, you know, just such a flawed witness to this, where only he sees something, which is kind of a Hitchcockian technique.
And, yeah, it was a nice rear window kind of thing. I really liked it.
Yeah, yeah. And then this period in history that's so fascinating, especially to the Jews, of how the Germans were perceived in this country at that time.
So I have a question. Did you base the couple, the Bowers, on real people that you researched? Is it how much of it is fiction? How much of it is based in fact?
It's fiction. I never really based them on anyone in particular. When I was in college, I had a landlady. When I lived off campus in Vermont, I had a landlady, Mrs. Bernheimer, and I sort of modeled her after Mrs. Bernheimer, going back 40 years, but no one closer than that. And they didn't resemble this other spy ring that I think I talked about it with you. Maybe it was the previous. I've done.
You do so many interviews, Andrew. It's hard to keep all the rabbis straight. Also, I'm sure
it's hard to keep right. But in any case, no. I mean, that was where fact ends and fiction begins.
The major character is really a flawed character, right?
Yes. And some of the technique of making him someone you want to root for, he is flawed at the beginning of this book. He is kind of, you know,
he's
disgraceful.
Drinking. Yeah, he's...
And he makes some really ill-advised personal decisions as well that cost him not only his job at Columbia, but another teaching position as well. And, it's part of kind of a little bit of the skill that I'm proud of as an author, that you take someone who your judgment of him is kind of disgraced, and yet you have to make him someone who transitions into a person you totally root for, I hope, you know, and because that's sort of it is a thriller, and in a thriller you need not only a strong bad guy, a strong villain, but you need a hero that arouses your sense of what is right and justice and what you as an author, as a reader, want to see happen in the book. So you have to root for Charlie, and I think he gets to the point where hopefully you do root for him.
You do. I mean, you sort of feel his... It's funny. I think his reform is also tied up with discovering and kind of struggling against this infiltration of into his life, where his kids get involved. I mean, it's really an interesting development. You know, you keep the pace moving so quickly in this. Some historical novels get bogged down in a lot of detail. You've got a lot of detail, but you keep it moving. Did you learn that with Patterson? Did you always have that?
I would suspect that I learned it originally with Patterson. Pace was always a big part of what he needs to achieve. I think it might be too much pace, because when you make things move too quickly, certain things are lost in the trade-off, and one of them usually is the scene setting and the sense of descriptiveness of atmosphere. And I've wanted on my last four books to employ a different pace. I'm still happy to hear you felt it moved along well.
I did.
Because I wanted to spend time on the settings and the atmosphere and the detail and the nuances of the times. But yeah, I probably got it from Jim, but with Jim going back a lot of books, I mean, I haven't worked with him in close to 15 years.
Right.
Pace was never enough. It was never fast enough, literally. And when he would edit me, because he would always get last draft, it was usually to remove things from my prose, not add them. But at this point, I like the balance of pages that move, but at the same time, you're paying attention to the kind of things that provide a rewarding book.
You know, I think it does. I think it moves very quickly. Spy thrillers sometimes feel like they're ADD and contemporary espionage, not just espionage, but contemporary dramatic stories move very quickly, where, you know, if you're reading Winds of War or something, it's not the same speed.
No. I mean, I still write thrillers, and I still, my editor probably wouldn't let me, you know, I don't try to be Herman Wouk or someone, but we are telling similar stories. His are about 300 pages longer than mine.
Yeah, just about, I would say. Talk about a little bit of, does this work, as you talked about with your previous book, has it developed some of your own Jewish consciousness?
Yeah, there's no question about it. I feel very much in a tradition now that at times I felt on the periphery of, and I sort of feel like I have this niche to myself, good or bad. Button Man was a book, the previous one was a book that is selling really, really well within the Jewish community, and I'm not sure that it's ever made the full leap as all my other books did out of the Jewish community into a larger audience. It didn't sell as well on an absolute level, but it's sold far better than anything on a in the Jewish community. And I do, I'm part of the Jewish book tour, Jewish book council tour, and like I said, I still probably have a good, I don't know, 15 things on my calendar going through Florida that are on, going back to Button Man, that I now have a new book out, and they said, no, we really want to talk about Button Man.
Right.
So it's given me this niche, and I like it. I mean, it makes me, what I like are these stories, or I like family stories, and as it relates to Jewish family stories, I like the, and I like them that are generational, because to some degree I feel a responsibility in my own world that if no one tells these stories, they're just going to die out in another generation. And I love the first generational stories that were part of Button Man, because this was really an immigrant story, which these stories totally die out if they're not told. So, yeah, I mean, I like it, and I feel very fulfilled in it, that role.
And I have to say, it's a good thing Jews buy books and read books. We are not the people of the book. We are people of the books, I think, in the plural. You know, it may not be as big as the overall market, but it's not too bad.
No, it's not too shabby. It's not too shabby, as we would say.
Not too shabby. Nish Kusher. I want to thank Andrew Gross for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and your stuff?
Online, andrewgrossbooks.com for certain, and Facebook, all authors, or most of the mystery thriller trade, are pretty easy to have access to, and Facebook, and I'm usually on there every day and love to respond to people.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, is a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrating our first services, classes, and events this fall, and our very first Jewish High Holy Days in just 2 weeks. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at 7315 North Oracle for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us for Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For our inaugural High Holy Day services, everyone is welcome. There is no charge to attend Beit Simcha on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but pre-registration is required. Call 520-276-5675 to sign up for the High Holy Days at Beit Simcha. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, the coming High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, or go to our website. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and its fastest growing at its exciting beginning. Thanks for being here with me this morning on Too Jewish. I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Bob Mankoff, prominent Jewish cartoonist of Moment magazine, on his new book, Have I Got a Cartoon for You? Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Jewish High Holy Day season, 2 weeks from tonight. Here's Zochreinu L'Chaim, Remember Us for Life, from Mordechai Gottlieb. Join us for the holidays at my own congregation, Beit Simcha. If you're in Tucson or southern Arizona, Rosh Hashanah arrives September 29th and 30th. Call 520-276-5675 to make reservations. No payments required, although totally voluntary donations are appreciated. Call 520-276-5675. And join us this Saturday night for Slichot. Our program begins at 7:30 p.m. with Havdalah, the film A Serious Man, study, dessert, and services with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.